nothing but a bathtub of flowers. I was working with the most artistic and famous photographers. I thought I was making art. And I was totally in exhibitionist mode without thinking there was a term for it. In some ways, I was just being. I was also playing a bunch of characters from Poison Ivy to Amy Fisher. One way to escape the child actress stigma was, ironically, via vixen parts. That certainly changed the perception, all right. Jobs started to roll in after the minor B-movie level of success with those projects. Within a few years, I was getting work, but I was also getting typecast. Even in the film Bad Girls, my big break back into a studio movie, we played hookers on a mission of vengeance. I wondered where life was going to take me with this double-edged sword of opportunities. Around this time, Steven Spielberg sent a copy of the issue of Playboy I'd posed in to my birthday party that had been redone by his art department. I was now wearing 50s-style dresses throughout the issue, and it was accompanied by a large quilt. The card read, "Cover up." Yes, I agree. But I had one last stunt to pull, although I didn't know it at the time. The stunt came after I created my Blue Angel character with my friend John, who, by the way, was a serious intellectual who read the dictionary so intensely that his dictionaries were the kind of tomes you had to read with a magnifying glass. Our game with our group of friends would be to pick a word from the dictionary and use it in as many sentences as possible that night. Like, "I only want to be philanthropic, but oh my goodness, you are so very misanthropic." The high-low of our need to stimulate the mind and yet find silly things to do at night was just a silly juxtaposition, of course. But we were just kids then. And again, no one had photographed or documented any of what happened at the Blue Angel. But somehow, word had reached David Letterman's producer, and when I was going on to promote a film, it came up in our pre-interview. His booker said, "Is it true that you and your friend did a show downtown?" I described Dick Haney and my character Lolita and how silly and quick and crazy it was. So he said, if it was okay, could I talk about it on the show with David? "Sure," I said. Again, I was in a very free state, and I had always loved David Letterman since the day he went on the air. I loved people who were smart and funny. It would become my favorite combination of someone's personality. So, of course, I would discuss it with Mr. Letterman. The night of the show was David Letterman's birthday, which made things very festive. I was on stage, and we started talking about the incident downtown. He and I were bantering back and forth, laughing and having a good time. I felt safe. As I was describing it, I suddenly, out of nowhere, got the idea in my head to start acting it out. And before I could even think, I was up on his desk. Trust me, had I thought this through, it wouldn't have gone that way. The moment was just one of completely uncalculated silliness that just started gaining motion like a runaway train. If I was trying to be sexy or get attention, it would have felt that way. You could see me trying to catch up to the train that was going, and after I was dancing on his desk, I guess I wondered how I could up the ante and strike a finishing moment, and boom! I lifted my top in a flash, only for David, where no one else could see. I was shocked at myself! And again, feeling like the train was ahead of me, I turned around and threw my arms up in the air and looked to the audience like, "What did I just do? Is this okay? Am I in trouble?" I didn't even know. But then I just thought, it's time to get off the desk and go back to my chair. And on my way there, I grabbed David by the tie and brought him in for a sweet kiss on the cheek. And it was sweet. But the reaction of what he would think of this whole moment hung in the balance. Thank God, he threw his head back and laughed. He let everyone know that it was okay to enjoy the moment and not overthink. This was a true moment of freedom, and it got to be something fun rather than something wrong. Thank you for that, Dave. When we got in the car after, I realized that this might make waves. I met up with my friends from the Lower East Side, and we watched the show together when it aired that night. As the show started, I said, so things might be a little crazy. And they asked me why, and I said, let's just watch. And we did. And as my dance on the desk started to fly, my friends were as shocked as anything you have ever seen, but elated, and the whole thing ended in cheers and people saying, oh my God, and I can't believe it! They weren't judging me, but they weren't exactly condoning it either. Wow. I had done something really out there by actually putting it all out there. As I watched myself and my friends laughing from an objective perspective, I realized right then and there that this was the end of an era for me. And so I started my journey into no sex scenes in movies, modesty clauses in my contracts, and a total lack of nudity in any public forum from there on out. And year after year, I became more uptight. One button higher on the blouse, 1 inch lower on the skirt. After that, even though it went so well and couldn't have come off with a better, more playful tone, I decided to take matters into my own hands. I knew that film had been my great opportunity in the past, so I needed to make it my great opportunity again. I wanted to be a good girl, and I wanted goodness to be the theme of my life and my work. I had a long road in front of me, but I was ready to walk down that ambiguous and unforeseeable path and do whatever it took to get there, even if I had to create the path myself. And I will say, it was when I found a script called Ever After that I knew I was on the right path. This film was a complete spin on the tale of Cinderella, and it started with a woman telling the Brothers Grimm that they got it all wrong. That she was actually a strong, bright, amazing woman who captured the heart of the prince with her mind and her strength. She said that she rescued herself instead of what we have been taught for years, which is that he rescued her. I fell in love with that story. Rescue yourself. It empowered me more than anything I had ever known to realize that we can be conditioned to believe that things are one way and then later be set free to understand that they can be different. Fairy tales are also always dark until that light comes in and it is earned. I wanted to rescue myself, and I did. I wanted to become a lady. And although it took years, I feel like I did. And I now know how to teach and instill the pillars of wholesomeness, and that it doesn't have to be boring. You can be a warrior and full of grace and class. That being free is about freeing yourself. In full clothes, of course. Corset, chastity belt, and full turtleneck. Flower life. One of the questions I get asked most, other than why are you so much shorter in person, is how do you do so much? First, thank you for even thinking that I do, but if I actually do, I believe it's because of the people I work with at our company, Flower. The thing that was so revelatory about Flower, which began as a film company but became so much more, was that By creating it, I was also building a family. It was also about learning that you do absolutely nothing on your own. By yourself, you are just a solo daydreamer. But with a partner or a team, you are unstoppable. I have worked with Nancy Givonin for more than 20 years on all the films we have produced. And almost every morning of my life, my first call is to Chris Miller, our other partner. He and I have worked together side by side for 17 years, and I cannot imagine life without either of them. We are all multitaskers and doers. We can spin plates, and yet, much like Nan, Chris always keeps a level head. I have learned so much from them about reaction, or how to handle things, or perspective. If Nan is my sister, then Chris is my brother. When I first met Chris, I knew I met someone as prolific as I wanted to be, and we also happen to share a sense of humor. Chris and I are of a similar age, and so all of our cultural references are the same, from old commercials to Mommy Dearest and Pretty Woman quotes. We work long hours, but we are laughing most of the time, and that's where my other valuable lesson came from. To feel blessed and recognize that working with people you like will make you want to work more. Everyone wears many hats, and we all like to do many different things at our company. We all dream stuff up, but more important, we find ways to make it a reality. We say to each other, "What about this?" And if we like it, we figure out a way to do it. We started out in 1994 as Flower Films. We wanted to produce movies. For 3 years, we didn't officially contribute, but we were allowed into the process on 4 films. The Wedding Singer, Home Fries, Scream, and Ever After. So that we could really learn how to do things with the greatest effectiveness as producers. It was invaluable, and we were grateful to everyone who was so open with us. Then we got to make our very first film, which was Never Been Kissed. And we labored over every little detail and could not have been more invested. And we put so much love into every minute of it. It worked well for the studio, but mostly we were relieved by the success because it meant we got to do it again. Next, we tackled Charlie's Angels, then Donnie Darko, 50 First Dates, All of the Other Reindeer, Duplex, Music and Lyrics, Fever Pitch, Whip It, He's Just Not That Into You, and more to come. We just tried to make stories that we really personally enjoyed and believed in. We kept our heads down and always tried to let the work speak for itself. To us, that was everything. Eventually, we made our employers an accumulation of almost $1 billion, which was once again a relief. We wanted them to be as happy as we were for believing in us. Now we work a little less due to having families, and we work on different things other than films as well, like all things Flower. Flower Beauty, a company I started 5 years ago, is my main focus these days. I get to work all day and night now at a job that is romantic in its art of creating pigments and innovations for color cosmetics. We scour the country, going to all different labs in search of the latest innovations for our lines, and yet it satisfies my business side as well because I am a part of the function and success of the brand. We also make fragrance and eyewear and expanding categories by the year. Most important, I run all the advertising and marketing and publicity, so that makes me think all day long about what women need and how to make them feel good. Positive images and messaging. I come from a storytelling background, and I learned so much about marketing as a producer. I love multi-generational brands, and I now think about Chanel and Estee Lauder and Clarins, brands that have families running them. I want my daughters to run this company if I have earned the right to keep it going. It's for women, by women, and it is a healthy mindset and life to bring my girls up in. I can also work from home sometimes and wake my kids up and spend most days with them, as well as do dinner, bath, and bed. I am a traveling salesman at times, but nothing that truly keeps me away. I have found a profession that is conducive to my life now in this most important chapter. Maybe I feel like I can do many different things because all my life I played characters that did different things. So that kept my mind open to fantasize. I try many other things. Photographer? Why not? I've taken pictures for the past 20 years. Sure, I can shoot the cover of that magazine or publish a book of my photos. Write books? Why not? It will only take me a solid, focused year of working on it every day. But yes, this needs to come out of me. So yes, I can do this. Make wine? Chris and I have traveled for 7 years trying to upstart our label, and here we finally are. We make wine with the Jackson family and travel the country to get it out there. I have an insane work ethic. I am strict with myself. I am trained to work. I don't know life without it. Work takes giving it your all, or it will not get done right. You have to kill yourself, do your homework, exhaust yourself. Focus on every detail. You have to put all of yourself into something with your heart and your gut instinct, your personal taste and your belief, or it will not get done right, which can lead to failure. Even if that failure is just knowing that you cut corners, and that is not an option. Again, I don't know where my motivation comes from. My parents were both hippies who really did not perform on any level. Whose genes am I pulling from? Ironically, Chris and I both come from single mother homes that did not have privilege on the outset. For me, whatever I lacked in stability or tradition was replaced by a great instinct of who to follow. Nan has lived all over the world and is adventurous, and Chris is up for going anywhere we need to be, geographically speaking. Due to being someone who started my own adventures so young, I recently calculated that I have lived in approximately 50 different cities, states, and countries for work or life. So I'm open to going anywhere. Mason Hughes, a gentleman at Flower, he and I have a saying, "You never know where the day is going to take you." And it's true. One day we're with a Chicago sales team for wine, and the next we're in Fayetteville, Arkansas at an optical lab visit for our Flower eyewear line at Walmart. And the next may be deep in Oxnard, California at a laboratory looking at the latest developments in skincare. Then one day I might find myself in New York at none other than Penguin Books with my editor, Jill. Love her. Finishing the final touches on this book, a book I had wanted to write for 7 years, but it was never the right time until now. So when I call my fellow flowers some mornings, I love that ideas are welcomed. We may not be able to do them all, but it is a safe place to dream. And sometimes, if you work hard enough, dreams come true. Adam. When I first met Adam Sandler, I was in my early 20s. I met him at a coffee house in Hollywood because I begged, borrowed, and stole to get him to sit down with me. He was very popular from Saturday Night Live and from his films Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison, the latter of which was directed by my friend Tamara Davis, who confirmed he is such a good person, which is everything. I was convinced at the time that we were supposed to pair up. I knew it. I knew it in my bones. I thought, Adam has a goodness that was so unique. I could tell that he possessed something different, and I was so drawn to his light. I wanted to make love stories, but I wanted them to have a certain energy that was about true love and chemistry and timelessness, and I was convinced of us doing something together. When I finally got to meet him, I showed up in a long vintage leopard coat with jet black hair, pink plastic high heels, and groovy sunglasses. Adam was in sportswear, cargo shorts, t-shirt, and baseball cap. It was definitely not obvious that we were supposed to fit as well as I believed because we looked like a preppy and a punk set up on a bad blind date. But I shook his hand with fervor and thanked him for meeting me, and I began to plead my case to him. I told him that, for whatever reason, I knew that we were supposed to become a team. I said that we both have production companies and clearly like working with the people we trust and want to find our own material. He wrote and I didn't, but I said that I had some ideas for films, and if he had anything written, would he consider seeing me in it and Taylor making it for us? It was bold, but I have always been a you only live once, so let your love show and take risks kind of person. He liked my pitch, and I had planted my seed. I was happy. I told him I would follow up. We hugged goodbye, and then he told me he was having a party, so I should come by, and I apprehensively did. His party was really fun, and lots of people were there, but I wasn't a big Hollywood social type, and I made a mental note right then and there that I didn't want to be seen as another party girl to him. I knew we were destined for something meaningful, and dating and socializing were not what I was after. Months later, I would check in here and there, send him scripts with a question mark on them. And one day, he called me. He told me he had the idea of a movie about a guy in a wedding band and that there was a script, but it would have to be completely rewritten. So, I came on board, and we got Carrie Fisher to write the girl's part to make it balanced. Frank Caracci was the director, and I just knew he had everyone's back, and I loved him. Then Adam and Tim Herlihy, his longtime writing partner, did their pass again because the whole script was theirs in the first place, and then they got their friend Judd Apatow to write on it. And after all these cooks came in, well, it was so good, I couldn't take it. And lo and behold, we were off to make a movie called The Wedding Singer. We had the most fun making it you could ever imagine. And I promise you, you can tell when people are having fun. It comes out through the celluloid and onto the screen, and it cannot be disguised. Adam's friends, who are his team, were the best, and I fell in love with all of them, including Alan Covert, an actor, writer, and producer who is in all of Adam's movies, and Jack Giraputo, his producing partner. We played, we partied, and we became real no-bullshit friends. When the film came out, we all rented a bus and went around New York, stopping at every movie theater we could. We would run off the bus, buy tickets, run in, watch 5 minutes of the film in whatever part it was in at that moment, and then scream, run out, get back on the bus, blast Daft Punk's album Homework, and go to the next stop. All while dancing the entire time. At the end of the night, when we got to Elaine's, a New York institution, the whole studio was there celebrating, looking at the weekend numbers as they came in, and it was all smiles. The movie was going to be a hit. And as relieved as I was just happy that Adam believed in me that day at the coffee shop and found us the perfect film to make. I wanted us to be like an old-fashioned movie couple. He was my cinematic soulmate, and maybe I had just proved it to him tonight. Many years later, we remained friends. We always talked about doing something again, but our lives had moved on in many ways, and we were not actively pursuing anything. However, I knew that we were always subconsciously looking for things as we read them, but for me, it was going to have to top what we did, and that wasn't coming easily. One night, my partner Nan, of course, as she always found the best projects, came and brought me a script. I was busy making a movie with Penny Marshall called Riding in Cars with Boys at the time, and Nan wanted to make this film right away. She said we could just produce it and find another actress. And I said, sure, why not? And then she asked me if we could stage a table read and I would read the girl's part and we would get someone to read the boys. It would help her hear the script so that she would know who to suggest for casting when she tried to go out there and secure the rights to the script. So we did. And as I read this script out loud, I realized why she loved it so much. It was a drama that took place in Seattle, and it was about a girl who lost her memory every day. But the guy would try to help her remember who she was. It felt small, deep, and very emotional. But above all, it was beautiful and romantic. I told Nan that she had to go and secure this film immediately. A few weeks later, she called me. They're giving the script to someone else, another company, and they won't say who. I was sick. There was something about this film that had lit a fire in me that not only wouldn't extinguish, it burned brighter by the week. I followed it like a hawk, and it very much did go to other people. It kept traveling, going from production companies to different filmmakers. They even attached other actors at one point. But I never gave up tracking its every move. There were huge movie stars and big-time directors attached to it, so it was very hard to even try to get it back. A few years later, I found out once again it had changed hands. Wondering who got to have it this time and seeing if there was once again a window for me and Nan to get back in, even though it was never ours, I found out that it had gone to none other than Happy Madison, Adam's company. Okay, I knew what I had to do. I sat down at my old Olivetti typewriter. Funnily enough, I was working on the Sony lot making Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, and his office was there, only a few hundred feet away. But I started typing nonetheless, and it was like conducting a symphony. The tears in me started to swell as I wrote about my history with this script, how long I had loved it, why I loved it, and how I truly felt once again in my bones that I was supposed to have something to do with it. And that the fact that this was with him, well, this was a film worthy in every way of our reteaming, and would he please consider doing this with me? Crying, I typed, "This is it! This is the one! I know it!" I hoped I wasn't being presumptuous, but I meant it when I said to him, "We need to make more movies." I took the letter, folded it up, put it in an envelope, and had it hand-delivered to his office. I counted the minutes and hours until I heard a response. It was like waiting to see the lighthouse in a storm. I awaited some kind of closure or my fate. Adam walked over from his office to our trailers at Angel's Base Camp. He said, "Of course we can do this, but we want to turn it into a comedy." And I said, "That's fine, but it can't lose its romance." And he said, "I know what guys want." And I said, "I know what girls want." And he said, "Well, then why don't you produce it with me?" And I said, "That's what I was hoping you were going to say." And I jumped into a giant, squeezy, laughing hug with him. Happy Madison and Flower Films. I was able to tell Nan that we were going to get to tell this story, as she always said. And so we did. We immediately went into meetings to take this drama into a more comedic world. Adam, Alan, Tim, and Jack were all there, all the same people we work with on The Wedding Singer. Adam is loyal and consistent with his team, as I am with Nan and Chris, so we all feel like family. We get how important respect is, and we all love each other. One day Adam said, "Instead of Seattle, how about Hawaii for where the film would take place?" And we all screamed, "Yes!" The next day, I would hand in a set of notes that all said, "Let's discuss," after each draft of the script came in. Because you really don't know what's going to work or not until you try it, especially with comedy. You have to not hinder that process. Nan and I would really fight for aspects of the love story, and it was a tricky one because you're dealing with daily memory loss, something that seems so otherworldly, and how that logic feels without losing the magic. It was a very interesting tone we were all trying to weave together. Nonetheless, we went off to Hawaii, and we had as much fun, if not even more, than we did on The Wedding Singer. A few days into shooting, I thought, this is paradise, and I just wanted to stay here forever. I have had a lifelong love affair with Hawaii, but I have never worked there. Cameron Diaz came to visit me. She wanted to escape a little, so she got the hotel room next to mine, and we had a little middle living room in between. Adam introduced her to his surfing instructor, Hans, and when I would leave in the morning for work, she would grab her board and go surfing. Then we would all meet up at the end of the day. Our two friends, Lana Vigi, who does hair, and Robin Fredericks, who does makeup on many of my and Cameron's films, and are part of our girl group. They worked on the film as well. And obviously, Nan was there. And let's just say that for 3 months, life was perfect. Cameron decided to stay a little longer, and then she never left. So we rented a ping pong table and put it in our living room, and it turned into headquarters. All the guys would come over and play. It was fun, wholesome, communal, and a moment in my life that just felt so safe I can't even begin to do it justice. And we were making a film I truly believed in, and the message of this film is, how do you make love stay? Because it doesn't matter if someone has memory or not, you have to reinvent love every day. It's why I chose the book Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins as the book my character Lucy reads every day, because that book asks the question and then goes on a wild ride just like the film. Love is the one uniting, relatable thing in everyone's life. It's what we all want and struggle with and fight for. And I loved the version of that we were telling here in Paradise. We decided to open the film on Valentine's Day, which is when we put The Wedding Singer out, so we thought, stick with tradition. I was hosting Saturday Night Live again, and because Nan and I were producing this one, I wasn't as carefree about the weekend as I was with The Wedding Singer. Weekends have become so important that it is very stressful, and you lose some of that feeling of what you intended because it's business at the end of the day. Did it work? Will you get to do it again? Those are always my questions because those are the facts. So I didn't want to know what the money numbers were until Monday. I wanted the weekend to be pure and for the movie just to be what it was, a story I really wanted to tell. But Adam showed up at SNL, his stomping grounds. He came into the dressing room with the whole gang, Alan, Jack, etc. I looked up at him. He knew I didn't want to know. We made small talk, but the cloud of success or failure hung in the air like a giant thunderstorm that would strike me dead or be the rain dance of joy. I knew by the look in his eye that he knew what I didn't want to know yet. But he couldn't help himself. Don't you want to know? His face was pokerish enough that I said, do I want to know? With a face that just ate a lemon. 45 million. We just broke records. And the whole room started screaming. And I started doing my rain dance and we all celebrated. This was one in a series of perfect moments. And above all, I was relieved. Years later, I called Adam one afternoon and said, can you meet me for lunch? And of course we did sometime the next day. We talked about how it had been another 10 years again, 20 in total since The Wedding Singer, and should we find something again? Adam has two daughters now, Sunny and Sadie, and I had my little Olive. We ate burgers and talked about what to do next and that we would go on the hunt again and find something. And we hugged goodbye on the street. A few months later, Adam found Blended, a film about the modern state of families. Now that we both had kids, I liked telling a story about literally families and what that means and what kids need and what kind of parent do you want to be, and all of those themes had never been more important in my life, and it just came together. And our friend Frank Caracci, who did The Wedding Singer, directed it, and it felt like home. We were off to Africa, and we all brought our families and made the film. I took Olive on safari almost every weekend and just made an amazing life experience and adventure out of all of it. I knew that my film life was winding down. The hours are so hard with kids. But with this group, the balance was there. I can be a mom and work because they celebrate their wives and their kids. It's very conducive to real life, and not all films are like that. But this was, and once again, we just had a wonderful and cozy, fun time making the film. At the end, we went to Georgia to shoot the part of the film that doesn't take place in Africa. We all lived on a lake, which is my favorite thing in the world, and after work, I would go and kayak by myself and take in my whole new life. I would acknowledge how I felt different. All that passion and drive I used to have towards movies was now dedicated to my kid. And yet, I was still lucky enough to do all of this with old friends. This odd man across the lake from me blasted "Rainy Night in Georgia" on a loudspeaker. And I just became still, right there in the middle of this water, happy with where my life had taken me. As we were preparing ourselves for landing after another round of very epic months of being together every day, we came to our last day of shooting. Adam and I had made another movie, and we just hoped people liked it. I was content, calm, happy, and then came the best news ever. I found out I was pregnant. I was going to have another baby. It was the perfect moment to be introduced to the notion of Frankie. So our film ended and my new adventure began. And I was amazed that Adam and I both have two daughters. It's incredible how life works. When Adam and I met, we were basically kids. But now we were in the same place in our lives again, but a very different place from where we started. We're not all playing ping pong. We are going to our kids' birthday parties. Adam's beautiful wife, Jackie, and I talk about being moms, and that's the conversation. Recently, at Adam's daughter Sadie's birthday party, Adam and I found ourselves in a corner. "What are we going to do next?" I asked. "I don't know. I have some ideas," he said. And then I turned to him and said, "Maybe it should be something really crazy and different." But then I thought about the heaviness of a drama, and would that make people happy? I don't know. And then I said, "Well, whatever it is, it's got to be good." And he said, "We'll find it." We both joke about how old we are going to be in the next one. We both are truly dying to remake On Golden Pond because it takes place on our favorite lake in New Hampshire. Funny enough, right where Adam and Nan both grew up. Small world. I think we also like the comfort of thinking we will be together when we are really old. Whatever it may be, and wherever it takes place, I know this. I once knew a boy named Adam, and I hoped that we could be a team. But what I found was a true partner. I now know a man named Adam, and trust me when I say, he is as great as you want him to be. The acting lesson. I learned the two most important things about acting by the time I was six. From 1976 to 1983, while my mom was trying to become an actress, she had us hanging out at the Strasberg Institute in Los Angeles. Lee Strasberg was one of the most important and famous acting teachers ever to live. He and his wife, Anna, were running the school. He had taught everyone from Al Pacino to James Dean, Dustin Hoffman to Marilyn Monroe, and many other icons of our time. Anna would soon become my godmother at my mother's request, a relationship that would become so important to me as a kid because she was so kind and nurturing. She put the mother in godmother and helped shape me for the next 7 years, mostly by just letting me live in her home and feel safe. Anna's home was like a beautiful commune in that the door was always open and people were always coming in and out. There was every famous actor you could ever think of, and great writers and directors. It was a salon type of place. There would always be several people watching movies or sitting in the living room having conversations. It was truly the most fluid, creative energy I had ever seen in a house. It was like a stimulating heaven. There were also Anna's two sons, Adam and David, who became like big brothers and helped me not become a wuss and turn me into a bit of a tomboy, which I greatly appreciated. Some nights, after Lee passed away, I would crawl into bed with Anna, and she would just let me sleep. It was so peaceful, and I felt like nothing bad could happen there. Anna had lost her soulmate, Lee, and I could not imagine what that feeling was like. I couldn't actually fathom it yet. But what I did see was that life went on in this house. And I mean life. The house literally buzzed. It glowed with love and whimsy and acceptance, a sense of family. This home formed me, but not until many years later would I try to replicate it. Now, I have a beautiful, welcoming haven myself. Anna taught me this. Back in 1979, my mother was doing a play at the Strasberg Institute called Playing for Time, about women in a concentration camp. My mother was playing one of the women in the camp, and they ended up giving me a small part as well. I was to play a girl who walks across the stage and says goodbye in German as she is taken off to be executed. I had two words to say, Auf Wiedersehen, and then I waved, and that was that. So absolutely heartbreaking, but important was this play. These stories needed to be told. The lead actress who carried us through the story was a tall, androgynous woman who had to be in the greatest turmoil throughout the whole play, every night, crying, screaming, fighting for her life. I didn't know how she did it. I was in awe of the fact that she could be this emotional every night. What did she do to prepare? What was her ritual and where did she go? So one night, I started looking. I would walk through the darkened theaters that were empty with all the ropes and curtains. I would follow the cables on the floor that wound around like snakes as they powered the bright lights that would illuminate the actors. These rooms were scary at night. Hundreds of empty seats, ghosts and dust. A silence that felt like something could jump out and come alive at any minute. Think the anticipation of a giant jack-in-the-box feeling. When a play is going on, it's alive. Now this theater was just a den of secrets waiting to be let out. But I braved these rooms in search of the crying woman. And then one night, I found her. I had gone into a different little theater in the building, and I hid behind a curtain so she could not see me. She was just lying down on the stage with her legs dangling off the edge, crying. And she would beat her chest and conjure up these monumental tears. Then it would subside a little. And then she would beat her chest again and moan as if she was dredging up the ocean floor of her own personal painful memories. And like the waves, her sobs ebbed and flowed from loud war cry to vulnerable smaller tears. And I realized that when she went out there every time, when she entered the stage, she was already in some truthful, beyond upset, flipped out state. And that was what she would provide to the audience of people. But it had come from such a private place in her, a place that she had summoned next door. Now that I knew how to find her, I spied on her night after night, watching her drum up the pain and start to wail. There were no actor tricks, no stepping into character at the last second. She was willing to unzip herself and get to a truth I'm sure most people would prefer to avoid. She gave herself fully. She intimidated me, but I could not stop watching her. Lesson one, make it personal. I was 4 years old. The second lesson came when Steven Spielberg on the set of E.T. said something to me when I was 6 years old. He said, "Don't act your characters, be your characters." I thought back to my nights of watching that woman cry in the empty room. She wasn't acting. She was being. Throughout my career, I would play many facets of things I actually experienced in life. It was cathartic and productive. I always had a way to channel things. The first film I did after E.T. was Irreconcilable Differences, about two parents going through an ugly separation with lots of family damage. I felt I had a lot to bring to that. Same with all the characters I played. Riot Girl? Check. Aspiring young woman who wants to rescue herself? Yep. Girl searching for love over and over? Check, check. Messed up woman who struggles to grow up and just wants a little attention, i.e. Edie Beale. Okay, we have a few differences. She had a much better fashion sense than I ever have. The truth is, I have never acted a day in my life. I think I would fail miserably at it. And the older I get, the more I have come to terms with so many things that I simply don't have the same drive to get to all the pain. And I think I have tapped into every girl who wants to find love. Now I'm just me. And nobody wants to watch a woman strive to be a normal mother of two, or maybe they do. Is there enough drama in that? Well, there is, but it might not be as cinematic. And any drama that occurs in my real life that I struggle with, I prefer to keep it private. So where does that leave me? Charlie's Angels 3, anyone? The truth is, I find acting jobs when something comes along and I can't stop thinking about it. It will keep me up all night. A fire starts inside that I cannot extinguish. I start relating it to my own personal experiences. I start seeing what I could do with it. I actually get territorial about it, thinking that I could do this because of X experience that I have lived through and understand. I can put that circumstance and the feelings I had with it. I can make it mine even though it's in the disguise of someone else. And maybe now it's about telling the occasional story that I really believe in and think would be good to put out there into the world. But as I look back, that crying woman taught me how to approach everything in life, acting or otherwise. Be authentic. Be yourself. And most important of all, make it personal. Flossie. When I was around 8 years old, my mother almost let me buy a dog. It was a black chow puppy. We were in Los Angeles at a pet store in the Beverly Center, And I had played with it in this strange room where they let you play, slash examine, slash bond, slash whatever. The room was more like a hermetic fluorescent lit closet, but I felt nothing but warmth and love. I knew I wanted this dog. We were at the register, and my mother was breaking out her checkbook, as that was the modern form of payment then. And as she started writing, my heart started pounding. I started fantasizing. This dog and I would talk, and this dog would be there to listen to me talk about my problems. We could sleep curled up in a bed. We could make it look like life was not so abnormal. We could look like a Norman Rockwell painting. And as my fantasies started to drift upward into the sunset, I saw her pen slowly stop writing. She turned to me and started talking about how this wasn't going to work, that we travel all the time for work, about how I probably wasn't ready for the responsibility, that this whole idea was bad and impractical and just not the right timing because life was just too hectic. You're goddamn right! It is too hectic! I have been working for the last 7 years and I'm only 8! You're nuts! Dad's nuts! And I want a friggin' anchor in my life! And this pile of fur was gonna be that for me! How dare you! And that check you're writing technically is my money as well, so if we have to saw this dog in half, I am leaving with this Linus-like security blanket of a dog, you heartless tease-slash-canine talk-blocker! Sad to say, she was still the adult, and we left that store empty-handed. And I wondered when I would ever write that wrong. Enter Flossie. When I was about 19, I started thinking that maybe it was time to try again. So I decided that I wanted rescues. Never a pet store again. Even when I set that scarring childhood moment at the pet store aside, it seems crazy to me not to save a life. I knew I wanted 2 dogs. Because I wanted them to have each other. So looking for 2 young rescues began. It took me months and months. After a series of shelters, newspaper ads, and various other sources, I was at the Pasadena City College flea market one Sunday, walking around, and there was a playpen of puppies that needed to be rescued. A whole litter! Instead of dropping them off somewhere or taking them to a shelter, the owners wanted to try this venue where they knew a bunch of people would be. There were about 14 in the litter, and I thought, holy cow. Not only could I get 2 kids that would have each other in this life, but also they could be siblings! Knowing this was the moment, I looked inside, and there were a bunch of blonde and beige pups. They were lab chow mutts that looked like little bears. People were rummaging through them like it was a sale bin of scarves. It was like a squished sea of moving, squirming fish. It was hard to decipher much, and then I spotted this one. I don't know what it was, but my heart just sang. That's the one, the hero dog. That's the little partner in crime I have been looking for. My long-lost sidekick! I just have to reach in and grab this one and then find a counterpart. As I plunged my hands into the sea of fur, a woman knocked into me, pushed me aside, and grabbed this dog. I gasped, "No!" I wanted to scream. I wanted to say, "That's my dog! I saw it first! We belong together, you don't understand!" She held up the dog and started clinically examining it, lifting its leg, checking the sex, holding it up without supporting its bottom. As she stared at this dog, time stood still. What was going to happen? Should I tell her? Should I strangle her? Was this the Beverly Pet Heartbreak take 2? The whole scene became quiet. I just waited, watching them about 2 feet away from me as fate hung in the slow-moving wind. I felt helpless and freaked. I think I went into some type of catatonic state. After all, I had been anticipating this relationship most of my life. And then the sound started to slowly turn up its dial, and the woman turned to me and held the dog with her arms extended and looked into my eyes and said, "She belongs to you." A smile erupted in all of my being, and I took this puppy in my arms, held her to me, and said to myself, "Thank God." And then I looked at her and said, "It's nice to finally meet you." And I was as happy as a human could be. But before the joy lasted for more than a second, my eyes popped open again and I thought, "Shoot, I need to grab your mate. The picture in my mind has two of you." So I turned back to the playpen. People were grabbing up all the puppies. People were in anarchy for these creatures. You would never know that there was an entire flea market full of treasures anywhere near. This giant box was where all the action was. So I clawed my way back in with my little hero under one arm, and with the free hand, I grabbed one of the last dogs, a boy. With a dog in each arm, I promised the owners I would give them not just a great home, but a great life. And I walked half a mile back to my car, opened up the door, and said to them, "Here is the car. Get used to it, because we are going everywhere together." After I put them in the back seat, shut the door, and then got into the driver's seat, I looked back at them and said, "Oh yeah, and we're not going to be neurotic either. We are going to have so much fun, it's going to make your head spin." And we did, for the next 16 years. Flossie was more Greta Garbo than Lassie. She was an old-timey gal with a flair for the dramatic. Calm as she was, she had a dry delivery about everything. She smiled after long days on the beach. She was able to express contentment, but she did not hop around spastically. That would be beneath her. She had a take-it-or-leave-it attitude and was a very cool customer. She also looked like a little white bear. Her brother Templeton was a boy who took a while to grow up, but when he did, he was a good little gentleman. He was much more hyper and lopsided in his approach to everything, but I proudly took them everywhere off-leash, and they were always good. Easy. They got it. One day, a few years later, I went to adopt another dog at the pound. I named her Vivian, and when I brought her home, she smartly walked up to Flossie and rolled on her back with her legs up in the air in the submissive position. Phew, I thought, because anyone who didn't kind of bow down to Flossie was going to have a tougher time of it. However, she walked over to Templeton and started pulling on his ear. And that was it. Templeton finally had a playmate with energy and whimsy. Flossie was never going to be like that. She was a solo flyer. So there it was, the four of us, and life was so good. We were Pied Pipers, and we went all over the world together, from the south of France to Austin, Texas. I actually got a Volkswagen bus, took out the back seats, and just let them cruise about the cabin. We swam in lakes in New Hampshire and oceans in California. We were a family, and when I picked up photography at 25 years old, they were my best subjects. They are the celluloid ghosts of evidence of a large chapter of my life. My life with them was free, and they forced me into the great outdoors all the time, which was good because I had them in some of my most workaholic and prolific years. They balanced my life and grounded me in every way. I always took care of them, usually putting their comfort before my own. And yet, these were truly the three easiest creatures you have ever met. Everyone at work loved them too. They were office dogs, car dogs, movie set dogs, you name it. They were such a part of my identity and lifestyle, and I never felt lonely with them. They slept on my bed. We would take long weekends. I would stare into Flossie's eyes and talk to her, and then take a photograph of her blonde eyelashes with a macro lens and make a piece of art out of it. Flossie's eyes were so calm and wise. She was an old soul. And without words, she was one of the beings I felt most connected to in my life. If you look at most of the pictures that have been taken of me during that time, these three dogs are in them. To document me was to include them because they were such a part of my life. Flossie had graced numerous magazine covers, fitting for the reincarnation of Miss Garbo. She outlived Templeton when he sadly died at 14. By some strange stomach flip, he went overnight just like that. I had never faced what life would be like without the three.